Well, it's good to be with you one more time. I appreciate all of you for being here. I will say this has been, I think, as far as the congregation goes, I think the best attended meeting that I have ever done. And that is a credit to you for your willingness to come out in each of these sessions during this meeting and to participate, to be around each other in love and in brotherhood, and to bear with me as I've gone through my material with you. I appreciate you bearing with me. I have a lot of quirky things about my personality, in case you can't tell. I have very strong and strange opinions on a lot of things. And I thank you so very much for wading through the quirkiness of me to see the point of the lessons that I've been trying to get at. Because somewhere in there, there's actually some wisdom, maybe, hopefully, that you've gotten out of this. I really appreciate you so much. It's been a great week. It's been warm and encouraging, and you all have, you've shown hospitality to me. We've built friendships together. We've rekindled friendships of people that I met 5 years ago. I've met area preachers who I'd never had the chance to meet face to face, and that has been an incredible blessing. Now, as we reflect on some of the things that we've talked about together this week, I want to start back at the beginning and just for just a minute here, get us to the point where we are tonight. Each of the lessons have very intentionally been constructed both as a lesson and where they are in the series to expand the scope as we've gone along together. Our first lesson together on Sunday morning was very much focused on boyhood. We talked a lot about just the boys themselves, about youth, and about the need for our boys to see good examples in their lives, to see good role models, and to grow into the men eventually that we hope and we pray that they're going to be. As we moved through each of those lessons on Sunday, we kind of expanded the scope to men in general. And then on Sunday night, we talked about a nature of man that we have to fight against, which is our aggressive and predatory nature that can be good if channeled in the right way, but can also be a terrible and dangerous detriment to our lives if we don't get it under control. When we got together on Monday and Tuesday, those were lessons that, again, broadened the scope of what we were looking at to moral excellence and to controlling our sins, our passions and our desires, sowing our wild oats. And you don't have to be a young man to understand a lot of the things that we talked about in those lessons about sowing wild oats and pursuing moral excellence. And so, as we've gone, we finally get to this last lesson. The scope is broadened out now to include the ultimate Father, the great Father, the paragon of everything that it is to be a Father. Our original, spiritual, and heavenly Father, God. And so I want to talk to you tonight about a phrase, and it will be more of a jumping off point. We'll talk a little bit about its construction in the language and what this phrase means, but it's a jumping off point to what I hope is going to be some really practical material for you. There's a phrase that we see sometimes in the Bible, and it is Abba, Father. Jesus said it. Paul wrote it twice, in fact. Abba, Father. I think a very memorable example of it that we'll begin here just to show it in use is from Romans chapter 8. This is a passage, by the way, if you want to put a bookmarker there. We're going to come back to Romans 8, and we're going to really hit that chapter hard here about halfway through the lesson. So put a bookmarker there. In Romans chapter 8, verses 15 and 16, the following phrase is used in context. For you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons and daughters by which we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit Himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God. So some of the questions that we're going to explore together today. It has become very trendy in a lot of religious circles, and I don't want to overstate the matter here. It's not like it's all over the place in every church in America or anything like that, but it has become very trendy in a lot of churches to casualize our relationship and interaction with God the Father. Now, in part, I will say, this is a good thing. Because for far too long, I think we've gone the opposite extreme in the way that we relate to and communicate with our Father. We use the very flowery and repetitious language that Jesus warned us against in Matthew chapter 6. In our own prayers with God, we use words we would never use in regular language, as if God is always going to be like a glorious old man with a long white beard in a marble palace far, far away. And you don't want to touch anything, get fingerprints, you know, on the furniture or anything in God's house. So you step very lightly when you're around God. But I wonder, do we use that same kind of language of our own earthly fathers? And before you get angry at me and throw songbooks at me or something like that, I'm not saying at all that we need to be as casual with God as we should with our earthly fathers, or that everything about those relationships crosses, okay? There's not always a cross-pollination, okay? There's not always a crossing of those things. But just think for a moment, if you spoke to your own dad the way that you speak to our Heavenly Father, that would be a fairly ridiculous conversation. You know, you get on the phone, "Oh, great Father, wouldst thou pleasest to listen to me, thy humble son, for but mere moments? Great Father, I have but one question, Father, to ask of thee, Father." You see what I do there? "How dost thou fix a lawnmower?" I mean, does that sound like the kind of relationship you would want to foster with your own father? I think the intent, though not without merit, is to get away from viewing God in such a stuffy and distant and ritualistic or formulaic way. But instead, this modern trend is to relate to Him intimately and casually, and even to use familial terms. Up on the screen, I do have one of those terms. Again, I'm not sure if this is as widespread as maybe I make it out to be in this lesson, so I don't want to overstate the case. But it has become very trendy in some religious circles to even refer to our Heavenly Father as Daddy God. Maybe you've seen that at some point. You've seen it on YouTube. Typically, it's the very cool youth pastor with sunglasses on the top of his head and jeans with the holes torn all the way down the bottom, right? Jeans with holes on, and he's got a tank top on or something that says "Jesus Love" across the front. He says, Daddy God, listen to our prayers right now." And so, what I'm saying is there's this pendulum that kind of swings back and forth between these extremes. And on the one end, you have this extremely formulaic, ritualistic idea of God. And we talk to God in rituals and in forms and in very flowery, repetitious language. And God is always arm's length. But then the other extreme, which I think is equally wrong, is this super casual way to approach God, where there is no longer the fear and the respect and the awe that we're supposed to have about Him. Let's be very careful not to be overreactionary when it comes to this problem. So I ask, are either of these extremes appropriate or even biblical? What does it mean that God is our Father? How does our language about Him and with Him reflect that relationship? What can we be doing better to fully understand and embrace God as our Father as He reaches out to us? And that's what I hope to explore with you in this lesson today. And again, you go, "Whew, he does really long introductions, doesn't he?" So let's look a little bit more closely at the phrase "Abba, Father." Now, some mistake that the phrase "Abba, Father" is actually a very childish phrase. The assumption is that Jesus and Paul and others viewed Abba as almost like baby talk in their time. And I understand why people make that assumption. It's an incorrect assumption, but I understand why we make it. Because Abba, mechanically speaking, linguistically speaking, is a very easy thing to say. And most of us, from the first time that we can speak, say words like "Abba." And I have an 18-month-old baby right now. I've had three other kids. I have four altogether. And I've seen the way that a word like "Abba" is very easy for babies to say. So again, the assumption is that, well, because it's a kind of an easy word to say and my baby says that word, then that must mean it's kind of a like a baby talk word. And when Jesus prays, Abba, Father, and when Paul says in Romans 8, Abba, Father, or in Galatians 4, Abba, Father, what Jesus and Paul are intimating is that you need to have a kind of a baby talk relationship with God. And while it is true that Abba is a very easy word to say for babies, and it is one of the very first verbalizations that a baby will make, because again, mechanically, it is a very easy thing to say, it was not in fact used in the time of Jesus to formulate some kind of stunted, immature view of God. In fact, it represents childlike trust in God. Now, notice, I'm very careful about this. I didn't say childish. I said childlike. Childish and childlike are very different things. Abba may be childlike, but that doesn't mean it is childish. There may be words that our children say from a very young age that are childlike, but they're not childish. Take the word no, for example. I mean, from about a year onward, most babies can say the word no. And nobody would say that no is a baby talk kind of word. In fact, the word no, though it is childlike, and any one-year-old baby can say the word no, it is, in fact, one of the most significant and important words in our entire language. Because the word no represents will and decision and volition and free will. And so nobody would ever say that no is a baby talk word just because babies can say it. The same is true with Abba. Abba is easy to say and babies say Abba, but that doesn't mean it's a baby word. Abba is not like passy or boo-boo or anything like that. Those are childish words. Abba is childlike. And I hope that that distinction is made clear to you. God is asking us in our relationship to Him, in the example of Jesus and in the example of Paul and the two passages that we'll look at in a moment here, God is asking us to relate to Him with childlike trust, but not relate to Him with childishness. And that's the point that I want to make in just a moment. The phrase Abba Father does appear three times in the New Testament, beginning with the utterance of Jesus Himself, quite memorably there in Mark chapter 14 verse 36, as Jesus is, He's weeping and He's praying in the garden, and He makes this supplication, this prayer in verse 36, Abba Father, all things are possible for Thee. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but Thou wilt. Now, would anybody accuse Jesus of being baby talk right there? Would anybody accuse Jesus of being immature or childish by reaching out to the Father by saying, Abba, Father? There's nothing else about that statement, nothing else in the context, nothing else about the work and ministry and life of Jesus that would make any of us go, boy, what a baby. Abba, Father, what a baby. Nobody gets that impression from Jesus in Mark 14 and other passages as well. He is, in fact, expressing this unwavering trust in God and God's will and God's power to deliver, even as He is personally buckling under the pressure of this massive weight in this circumstance. Paul also uses the phrase in Galatians chapter 4, and in verse 6, a little bit later here in the New Testament, Galatians chapter 4 and verse 6. Now, for context, I want to pick up here in verse 1, and let's read a little bit here out of Galatians 4. Galatians chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, follow along with me if you will. Now I say, as long as the heir is a child, he does not differ at all from a slave, although he's owner of everything, but he's under guardians and managers until the date set by his father. So verse 3, so also we, while we were children, were held in bondage under the elemental things of the world. But when the fullness of the time came, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, in order that He might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. And verse 6, Because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of His Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Therefore you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. And when I put this lesson together the first time and preached it a few months ago back home, as I was studying Galatians 4, something jumped out at me that in almost 40 years of life, I don't think I ever noticed before. And, you know, sometimes when you kind of are surprised by something, maybe you seize upon it more than you should. Like, you get super excited, and you're like, oh, I show that to everybody. But something that I just, it didn't really ever dawn on me until I really dug into this passage was, there in verse 6, because you are sons, God has sent forth the Spirit of His Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. Who is crying, Abba, Father, there in verse 6? Take a look at the way the sentence is built. Who is the one crying, Abba, Father? The Spirit of Jesus is. God sent the Spirit of His Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. In that moment, I am not the one saying, Abba, Father. In that moment, it is the Spirit of Jesus in my heart crying, Abba, Father. Now again, before you pull the songbooks out and throw them at me again, I'm not saying let's dim the lights and hold hands and that Jesus comes and makes us say this and it's really Jesus speaking through. I don't want to take that away from this passage and say that there's something, you know, something kind of like esoteric going on there. I have a more practical explanation for you. Because, I mean, it's a little confusing, isn't it? The Spirit of Jesus is sent into our hearts, and it's Jesus crying, Abba, Father, from my heart. What exactly does that mean? Now, I'm not adopted. But I bet some of you are. And if no one in this room is at least adopted, any adults in this room, I know that there are children in this room. Some of these kids are adopted. And so anytime you talk about adoption, you have to be really sensitive about that and understand there's a lot that goes on to that process. Psychologically, emotionally, family structure, all of that. And so bear with me as someone who is not adopted. I can only speak so much, but bear with me as I make this analogy. I imagine that if I was adopted into a family, what I would find is that this family already has established customs, established boundaries, favorite things that they do. Everybody's already got their seat at the table. Do your families have a seat at the table, right? Everyone's got their seat at the table. I don't know why it matters, honestly, but my kids have their seat at the table. But if you were adopted in the family, wouldn't you feel a little bit like, I kind of stick out, don't I? I mean, everybody knows their role. Everybody knows what they're doing. I'm kind of just inserted into this thing, into an already established family dynamic. Now, with that awkwardness being said, imagine what it would be like then if your new adoptive brother comes up to you and puts his arm around you and says, you're going to love Friday night family game night. Every Friday, we do family game night. It's your first family game night. You're my new brother. I want you to be my partner for family game night. Now, I know that's just a little analogy, but I think what Galatians 4 is saying is that God has sent forth the Spirit of His Son, like putting an arm around adopted brother. And saying, Abba, Father, you're my new brother. You're my new sister. We cry Abba, Father together. And I'm with you right here. I'm your brother. I am the Son of God, but you've been adopted into God's family, and I'm pulling you in now. I'm bringing my brothers, my sisters in with me, and we're crying Abba, Father together. And if you're not at that point yet where you're super comfortable, I'll cry Abba, Father for you. I'll make up for you. And someday when you are comfortable, you'll cry, Abba, Father, too. I think that, when I thought of it that way, Galatians 4 made a whole lot more sense to me. And to know also that when I'm adopted into God's household, I'm not like a, I'm not a second-class family member. I'm not like, oh, well, that's our adopted brother, Ryan, over there. No, it is full adoption. It is full familyhood. It is Jesus putting His arm around you, making a claim to your life as a part of His family, and crying, Abba, Father, with you and through you. And that is an amazing, amazing thing. Now, the phrase itself has a very interesting history. It's an Aramaic phrase. Abba, I should say, Abba is an Aramaic word. And father, of course, comes from a Greek word, pater. But the phrase Abba, again, doesn't represent baby talk. What it represents is deep, childlike trust in God. Outside of reason. Like, it's beyond reason. And if you look at the definition itself, that is part of the point that Vines brings out in his dictionary on New Testament words, is that this, it has nothing to do with reason. And here's what I think is meant by that. If you pick up your baby, right, this your baby, your brand new baby, boy or girl, and you are holding that baby, and that baby is swaddled and warm and comfortable and well-fed and loved and brought into you, does any new father or mother have to sit there with their brand new baby and say, okay, now I'm Ryan Goodwin, I'm your dad, this is Rebecca, she's your mom. I do the job that pays a mortgage. We'll tell you about mortgages a little bit later, but you gotta watch out for that. Nobody sits down and explains to their baby, like, I'm your dad and you can trust me. The baby needs no explanation. It is an unreasonable, inherent trust that that baby has. When you are holding your baby, does your baby know it? Does your baby know it? Oh yeah. It is an unreasonable, inherent trust in your father and your mother. Now that's the first half of it, the Abba, this childlike trust in God. But what about the Father? Abba, Father. The Father comes from a Greek word that's pater, and it's a term that is used respectfully. That's the title you refer to your dad as. He's my father. That's my father. It's respectful. It is fearful. It is honorific. And so when you put Abba and Father together, what you've got then is the perfect combination of these two beautiful things, which is the childlike trust in your Father, in Abba, and the respectful, honor-filled greeting or term of your Father. That's reasonable. Put them together. That's really what we want, is to put them together. And I want that with my own father. I want that as a father with my children. I want, as we grow together, that our relationship changes. Like, for now, I've got an 18-month-old baby, and for now, I don't expect a lot from her as far as our relationship goes. But I do want her to trust me. When I pick her up, I don't want her to squirm and squeal like she thinks I'm going to drop her on her head or something. I want her to trust me. I'm fine with the Abba for now. If all she can give me is Abba, great. But when that same 18-month-old is 18 years old, I would like in those 18 years, or 17 and a half, I'm really bad at math, I was an English major, in the interim from 18 months to 18 years, I would like the relationship to have evolved from just Abba to also include Father. Yes, I still trust you. Yes, I love you. Yes, I'm warm and I'm close and all those things that I had when I was a baby. But I also, at 18, I respect you, Dad. And I fear you, Dad. And I honor you, Dad. And I'll listen to you, Dad. Father. I want both of those things in my relationship with my children. I want both of those things in my relationship to my own father as well. Which brings us to this other reference here of Abba, Father, which we already alluded to earlier in the lesson from Romans chapter 8. And by the way, one thing I want to point out, just in case I forget about it, I have a note written here on my page to remember this. So I'm going to remember it now so I don't forget about it. This is brand new. I just came up with this afternoon. Okay. If you take a look at these three references to Abba Father, I have actually lined them up in such a way as to show that in the first reference, it is Jesus himself saying Abba Father in Mark 14. And in Galatians 4, it is still Jesus saying Abba Father, but it's Jesus through you. But notice in Romans 8, who is saying the Abba Father now? It starts off as Jesus by himself saying it, and then it's Jesus speaking it with you, and then Romans 8, we cry Abba Father. That's that development. That's that maturing of our relationship with God. So Romans chapter 8 and verse 12. So then, brothers and sisters, we are under obligation not to the flesh to live according to the flesh. For if you are living in accord with the flesh, you're going to die. But if by the Spirit you're putting to death the deeds of the body, you will live. For all who are being led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons and daughters of God. For in verse 15, you have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again, but you have received a spirit of adoption as sons and daughters by which we cry out, Abba, Father. The Spirit himself testifies with our spirit that we are children of God, and if children, heirs also, heirs of God, and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, so that we may also be glorified with him. I like that reference to fear there. You have not received a spirit of slavery leading to fear again. You're not a second-class family member. You're not just God's adopted kids. Like, ugh. Well, I've got Jesus. He was a straight-A student. And then I've got, those are my adopted kids over there. No, there is no fear. Or like 1 John chapter 4 points out, there is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear, because where fear is, there's judgment involved. And so we don't feel this fear again. We feel boldness and confident. We have access to God through Jesus so that we can join with Jesus now. The same way that he cried out Abba Father in Mark 14, we can now cry out Abba Father as well. What a relief it is also to be able to cry in that way to our Father. What a relief it is to let go and to fully enjoy and nurture and foster the childlike trust in God that is complemented with the grown-up understanding that we gain. So Abba Father, just to sum up this first part of the lesson, that was just the second part of the lesson now. Oh, that's a really long sermon, Ryan. Abba Father is the beautiful combination of two qualities that both must exist in Christians. We have the Abba and we have the Father. The Abba, like small children, represents holding out our arms to the Heavenly Father to trust Him, to know Him, to be held by Him, and to be loved by Him. But the Father part of that represents a growing and maturing understanding of who God is, a deepening of our knowledge of Him through the Word, and a maturing in our experiencing and showing our faith in Him. You got to have both of those things. It's great to have Abba, but you need to mature a little bit in your understanding of God. It's great to have Father, but if you're keeping God at arm's length and God is nothing but just a distant, just a distant, intimidating being out there, then you are missing that. Which brings us to the practical application. Practical application, I think, is summed up in a really great passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and verse 20. Brethren, be not children in your thinking, yet in evil be babies, but in your thinking be mature. I think that's exactly what we've been saying this whole time, isn't it? Do not be children in your thinking, be mature. Be the Father part of that, the reasoning, thinking, maturing, growing Christian. But when it comes to evil, have the innocence, the Abba part of that, as baby. So let me give you four quick practical applications on this point, and then we'll start wrapping the lesson up. In evil, be like babies. A couple of applications here. First thing I would notice then about this is all analogies do break down if you push them too far. So when we talk about being converted and becoming like little children or being like little babies, we have to understand God is not telling us to be like babies in every way. Think about some other analogies that are used in the Bible. Jesus himself compared himself in Matthew chapter 23 to a chicken. But would any of us say that Jesus is like a chicken in every way? No. In Matthew chapter 23, he's looking at Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often I wanted to gather you together the way that a mother hen gathers her chicks under her wings. So he compares himself to a chicken, but none of us would assert that Jesus is like a chicken in every way. He's like a chicken in one way, but he's not like a chicken in every way. So when Jesus says, in Matthew chapter 18, to become converted and become like little children, Jesus does not mean become like a child in every way. Sorry, kids. You guys are really weird. I'm just going to say it. Let's just be real about this. Kids are weird, and they smell bad, and they're noisy, and they have no idea what they're talking about most of the time. Like, kids are weird. So we're not supposed to be converted and become like little children in every single way. But we are called to imitate at least one aspect of being like little children, which is to emulate the simple trust of children. And it is ironic that as we get older, most of our big problems in life, stuff that we've talked about this week, sin problems, relationship problems, maturity problems, morality problems, most of the big problems in our life really just boil down to a lack of trust and faith in God. I mean, what does Hebrews chapter 3 say? When that generation of Israelites was wandering through the wilderness for 40 years and they ended up all dying in the wilderness, what does the Hebrew writer say was the central problem that they had? They did not have faith. They did not trust. They didn't trust. So they all died in the wilderness because they didn't trust. And it's so ironic, isn't it, that something that comes so naturally to us at 5 years old is so hard at 50. Any five-year-old child trusts implicitly his or her parents. When you say, jump into the pool, jump into the lake, I won't let you drown, the little five-year-old kid just jumps on in. They just do it. They trust. In a crowd of strangers, you know, your child is lost in a crowd of strangers. They don't see any face they can trust. And then all of a sudden, the crowd parts, and there's mom's face. And there's dad's face. And in a crowd of 500 people, suddenly there's one face that they can trust, that they're drawn to. That came so naturally to us at 5 years old. But we grow up and we become bitter and jaded and cynical, and everybody's out to get us and everybody's swindling us and everyone's a sleazy car salesman. So we don't trust anybody. We don't have faith in anybody. And most of our big problems, I think, just boil down to we lack trust. And so Jesus says, be converted. Whoa. Be converted and become like children and relearn how to trust. Read Psalm 131, for example. And every time I read this passage, I feel like this would have been much easier for me to say as a five-year-old than now. Psalm 131, in fact, the subtitle in New American Standard is Childlike Trust in God. O Lord, my heart is not proud, nor are my eyes haughty, nor do I involve myself in great matters or in things that are too difficult for me. Surely I have composed and quieted my soul, like a weaned child rests against his mother. My soul is like a weaned child within me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time forth and forever. How many of you can honestly say that prayer and mean it? We're not very good at trusting. We're not very good at it. We've got to relearn how to do it. Another point here, in evil be like babies. Children also have a sense of awe and wonder that we tend to lose. It gets lost along the way. You know, we've seen enough stuff, we've done enough things that we become pragmatists, we get bored, we have bitterness over things. You know, our children see, they see a bug walking around on the ground and they're just enthralled by it. They notice the butterfly that we hardly ever take stock of. They smell the flowers that we stopped smelling years ago. They look at the creation, and sometimes out of the mouths of infants and nursing babies, the most amazing things are said. When your child looks up at the sky and says, God did a really good job today, and you look up and go, thanks for the reminder. You're right. God did a good job today, didn't he? We need to be more like children in that way. And then there's the innocence, the spiritual, the moral innocence. Because they trust their parents, children also accept the message that there are good things and bad things out there. And they take it as black and white. Choices are binary. And they're often very straightforward. These are the bad influences and these are the good influences. This is the right thing to do, this is the wrong thing to do. And children accept that. Children accept it. That's why every children's movie has a good guy and a bad guy. And the bad guy's always got a swirly beard or something like that. It's always Jafar, right? It's because it's binary. And children are willing to accept the binary nature of good and evil. But when you become an adult, suddenly good and evil are not so binary anymore. And good and evil are debatable. And the serpent shows up in the tree and says, you mean God told you not to eat from that fruit because he said you'll die in that day? Huh. That's debatable. And then we look at the serpent and go, you make a strong point. That's what we do with evil. We rationalize it. We justify it. We look for the end around. We look for the loophole in everything. Things are not as... And so I think one way that we can become more like children is to go back to that age when there was bad and there was good. There is God and there is everything else. And you either take God or you don't. You either go to heaven or you go to hell. It's only when we become adults that we start going, I don't think I'm comfortable with this concept of hell. I'm going to find a way to rationalize hell out of existence because I don't like that part of the Bible. Children don't ever say that. Children just say, wow, hell sounds really bad. I better not go there. Good. And I wish we all had that attitude about hell. It's awful. I don't want to go there. But in your thinking, be mature. Isaiah chapter 46 very beautifully shows that God is our Father at every age. When we're young and when we're old, when we're immature and when we finally grow to maturity, God says in Isaiah 46, beginning in verse 3, listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel. You who have been born by me from birth, and have been carried from the womb, even to your old age, I shall be the same. Even to your graying years, I shall bear you. I have done it, I shall carry you. I shall bear you, and I shall deliver you. What I love about this is, here is God saying, when you were young, and you were immature, that was me guiding you along. I've been your father the whole time. When you're old, and when you're looking back on a life well spent, that was me. I'm your father still, and I don't change. Now, you change. You know, you go from being scrawny and immature and naive about things to becoming an adult, and you got your whole life figured out, to hopefully a place of maturity someday where wisdom guides you. And throughout all of that, you know who's interwoven in your life from age to age? It's always been God. He has always been there. 1 Peter chapter 2 says we need to grow up. We need to be built up. We need to be nurtured by what God provides in His Word so that we can grow up. Hebrews chapter 5, the writer of Hebrews expresses this lament for the people reading his book that by this time you ought to have been teachers. I expected you to grow up a little faster than this, but instead I've got to go back and talk about the basic principles again. I thought we were ready to talk about calculus, and here you are wondering what a rectangle and a square are, and a triangle and a circle, and I've got to go back and talk about the elementary principles of God. Now, I like the way he puts it here in Hebrews chapter 5, just in those last couple verses. You know, by way of summation on that point that you ought to have grown up, he says in verse 12, though by this time you ought to be teachers, you've need again for someone to teach you the elementary principles of the oracles of God. You've come to need milk and not solid food. And I like verses 13 and 14 here. For everyone who partakes only of milk is not accustomed to the word of righteousness, for he's a baby. But solid food is for the mature who, because of practice, are you listening? Who, because of practice, they're doing the right things, they're reading the right things, watching the right things, listening to the right things, who, because of practice, have their senses trained to discern good and evil. And when we have our senses trained to discern good and evil, we will grow up in all aspects into Him. So we go from boys to men. To men? To men. And we cry, Abba, Father, when we're finally ready to let go of control, when we're finally ready to let go of self-will and pride and arrogance and bitterness and sinful habits, when we're finally ready to relent and become like the babies spiritually that we're meant to be, while living as the men that we're called to be. So we, like Jesus and like His Apostle Paul, cry out, Abba, Father. Now, if you're not a Christian here this evening, you really ought to be. Jesus made things very simple for us, didn't He? If you believe and you're baptized, you'll be saved. Because God really loved this world. He really loved this world. He so loved it that He gave His only begotten Son so that through Jesus Christ you can come to the Father. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through Me. I'm the light of the world. It's time for you to decide what you really think of Jesus. It's time for you to decide how you're going to respond to that gospel message. It's time for you to stop being immature in your thinking and finally grow up. It's time to become a Christian if you're not a Christian already. But if you are a Christian, maybe you've just been doing it in form all these years, but not in substance. You've gone through the motions. You're not who you're supposed to be. You're not the man or the woman of God that He has called you and commanded you to be. Well, make your life right with Him now. Put the sin behind you and grow up. It feels really good to cry out, Abba, Father, and to know that you're a part of His family. And if you don't share that confidence to cry that phrase out, then please make the changes in your life that are necessary. Whatever spiritual need you have, please let it be known.